Welcome back to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love to talk about movies. I'm CJ Talbot, and joining me as always will be Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. For this episode, we're discussing Quentin Tarantino's 1992 debut feature, Reservoir Dogs.
And we're off and running. Welcome back. Okay. How we doing, Cesar?
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah.
It's been a busy couple of days, so it's nice to relax a little bit.
Yeah, it's been pretty busy for me.
I'm sure.
Even though I'm not working retail this holiday season, I am working in a business where it, you know, obviously gets busier during the holiday season as well. Package delivery and shipping and receiving. So we actually worked both Saturday and Sunday this past week, so I haven't had a day off for 2 weeks.
Oh, well, are you off today?
No. Just a brief respite while I watch a good movie and talk about it with a good friend.
Oh, okay. Sounds good.
Not you. Somebody else.
Oh, yeah. I was sure about that. I was thinking, which friend?
Kidding, obviously. Kidding. I'm all the way over here in California. You know, the place is burning down. Haven't you seen the news?
Yeah, it's pretty scary looking.
In all seriousness, no bullshit, it is fucking scary. It really is.
Is it pretty close to you guys?
It's not super close to where our community is, but, I mean, it's like all of Southern California is, like, up in flames. There's just, like, pockets of wildfires everywhere. It's like, I was watching the news last night, and there was, like, a big fire right off the 405 near L.A., like literally, like right off Mulholland Drive. Like you could drive down the street, and on the left hand side of the car was just like flames everywhere.
Was that a video that taken at night?
Yeah,
I might have seen a video if it's been circulating.
It was super fucking scary, and
I guess it's a movie podcast, but I described it. It looked like Mount Doom.
Yeah.
Out there.
Yeah. Well, you know, they had that wildfire movie with Josh Brolin over the summer. What was that called?
Josh Brolin?
Yeah, it was Josh Brolin, and it was directed by the guy who did Tron Legacy.
Oh, I don't recall. I didn't see it.
I missed it, but, you know, now I wish I had seen it, just in case there were any tips that I needed.
See, like, I don't know if there are many wildfire movies. I know Howie Long was in one back in the 90s. But
Firestorm. Yeah. That's a deep cut right there. Firestorm. You're pulling that one out.
Well, I know I'm aware of the film. I can't say I've seen it, though. The one thing I do remember in the trailer is him hanging on a line from a helicopter swinging through fire.
Yeah. You know, that's funny because he was in Broken Arrow, right? That's how his quote-unquote movie career got started, right?
Yep, I guess so.
Yeah, so, like, Firestorm was, like a year or two after Broken Arrow when they thought Howie Long could be, like, a Hollywood star.
he's got a pretty strong jaw, so I guess.
He does. I wouldn't mess with him. We love you, Howie.
Besides the fact that he was also a professional football player.
Right. He still looks like he could tackle a guy pretty good.
Yeah.
So, hey, aside from wildfires, we can move back into the cinematic realm. What have you been watching? Anything good?
Well, to be honest, like I mentioned, it's been busy, so haven't really had a chance to watch too much stuff. I did, thankfully, get a chance to revisit a film that I probably hadn't seen in a long while. And that is a Japanese film, of course, Shinji Iwai's April Story. I bought a box set of his films, a Korean box set, because inexplicably a lot of the Japanese releases do not have English subtitles. But his films have a pretty solid following in Korea. So there was a box set released recently of three of his more popular films in that country. I bought it maybe about a year ago, but it was the last film in the box set that I hadn't sat down and watched. It's a pretty short film, less than 70 minutes, honestly, and it feels like almost like a slice of life film.
Okay.
But, you know, it's absolutely gorgeous. Music's really good. It stars Matsu Takako, who is amazingly beautiful in the movie. Like, I could see... the movie is circa 1998, 97, somewhere around there. But I could definitely see men across the country, like, falling in love with her because of this movie. But, yeah, I'm actually...
Nice.
Going to be posting a review of it pretty soon, so I did write one up. It's gonna go up probably the next few days, so I guess we could link it at the end of the podcast. So
okay, well, like I said, I've been working a lot. I haven't watched a whole lot of stuff in the past week, to be honest. And I want to apologize to our listeners. I just started editing and putting together our last episode that we recorded, which is on Richard Donner Superman. So that'll be out this week. It'll be out soon. Sorry for the delay.
It'll be a Christmas miracle.
Not a miracle. It'll be a super present
for your ear holes.
Yeah, we'll cut that part out. But over the last week or so, I've only watched Reservoir Dogs and a couple other movies, but one of them was Okja. Have you seen that yet?
Still haven't. No, I want to be in the right mood for it. I haven't hit that mood point yet.
I think American audiences are probably going to, how can I put this? Like it's got a weird confluence of like different tones in the film. The story is about the name Okja is this giant sort of super pig that has been genetically engineered by a corporation. And what they did to try to combat hunger, I guess, is they created like dozens of these super pigs and they sent them off into the world to just grow, to get big. And, in the mountains of Korea, this little girl and her father, sort of like are, I guess they're farmers or ranchers or whatever. And she grows up with Okja, the super pig, as sort of like a pet. And she doesn't understand what's going to happen to Okja eventually. And when they come and take Okja away, it sends her on a journey to try and get Okja back. And it's very heartfelt. It's extremely funny. But there's also these really wild, like, mood swings, too, where, like, they get into sort of, like, you know, the idea of animals as food product, and there's some tough moments in the film that deal with that. And, you know, Tilda Swinton is in it, and Jake Gyllenhaal is in it, and it was directed by, let me make sure I get this right, Snowpiercer guy, Bong Joon-ho, is that it?
Well, I pronounce it, who knows if it's correct, Bong Joon-ho.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go with what you said. But I quite liked it a lot. The only thing that kind of prevented me from giving it like a really high rating was that I felt like there were a couple of scenes where there was a mix of tones in the scene, and it didn't quite work for me. And I don't want to really give anything away specifically, because the one scene I'm thinking of would be a big spoiler. But Jake Gyllenhaal does this really sort of over-the-top, sort of like American Steve Irwin character. So he's like a famous animal, you know, personality from TV, and he works with the corporation. And he's sort of wild-eyed, but he's also very washed up, and feels like he's sort of at the end of his celebrity. And there are a couple of scenes with him that I don't feel quite work for me 100%. Although, if I end up watching the movie again, which I'm sure I will down the road at some point, maybe it'll gel a little bit better for me. But overall, I definitely had a lot of fun watching it. And like I said, it's very heartfelt. So there are moments in the film where, you know, if you're into it, you're going to get caught up into those emotional moments too. So I, you know, I liked it. I definitely recommend that you watch it, and I think a lot of our listeners would appreciate it and enjoy it too. So.
When I saw the trailer, of course, you know, it's fantasy, but immediately to my mind came a documentary, a Korean documentary from about 10 years ago called My Old Partner. It's about, the movie was about an 80-year-old man, 80-year-old farmer, who for the last few decades, his best friend was this cow on his farm. Now, as both of them start advancing in age, you know, they can't do the work together, but they still rely on each other for pretty much everything.
Yeah.
I guess the dramatic thread of the film is the cow becomes diagnosed with a form of bovine cancer.
Okay.
And the documentary basically follows the farmer and the last year he has with his best friend, the cow.
Wow. That sounds incredibly heart-wrenching.
It's absolutely brutal.
I mean, it does sound like it's a appropriate double feature with Okja, but wow, I'm not sure I'm going to be rushing to watch that anytime soon.
You know, I don't believe it's got a domestic release, but I do believe it played at Cannes and at Sundance.
Yeah.
There's at least some notoriety in it in English language circles. So
nice.
I'm thinking about it right now. My eyes are watering a little bit.
All right. Take a second and compose yourself and we can move on to Reservoir Dogs. Something where you probably won't get terribly emotionally attached to the story at all.
Yeah, you're right. Okay. I'm sorted. You know, it made me feel wistful just then. But it's not going to keep me from eating a cheeseburger.
Good. We certainly wouldn't want you to miss any of your red meat meals.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
I know you love your beef.
Yeah, where's the beef? In my stomach.
Do people get that reference these days?
Of course they do.
That where's
only old,
where's
only old listen to our podcast.
You're probably right. Where's the beef was a Wendy's slogan back in the 80s. Where's the beef? Okay.
You don't need to explain. You're ruining it.
All right, fine. I'll cut that part out.
Okay.
Not really. Oh, you know, before we talk about Reservoir Dogs, you know, a lot of our Baltimore area fans, since we are both from Baltimore, a lot of our friends and a lot of our former coworkers are probably aware, but they're closing the Suncoast store in White Marsh Mall, which was, you know, my old stomping ground.
Yes, it was pretty sudden news. And I guess end of an era, mostly.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody the other day. It's, you know, I've got Hulu and Netflix, and I'm an Amazon Prime subscriber. And the movie selection, even across the board, if you combine all three of them, is horrible. And I know it's easy to, you know, to pay on Amazon Prime or something to rent a movie or to pay on demand to rent a movie. But I don't think cinephiles, movie fans, are really, like, winning the battle here. We're losing big time. You know, like by physical media disappearing and these movie stores kind of going out of business, you know, we're not just losing a cultural touch point, you know, where we kind of gather in a place and discuss these things in person and interact as human beings. But we're also, I think the pool of what we can watch is getting smaller and smaller because, you know, a lot of these places like Hulu and Netflix are going more for original content, but there's, you know, there's places like Shudder and Filmstruck, but, I mean, ultimately you're going to have to subscribe to all these different a la carte-like services, you know, just to find the movies you want. I think, ultimately, in the long run, for a lot of people, it would just be cheaper to go buy the DVD or the Blu-ray than it would be to subscribe to six different services all year long for this stuff.
Yeah, I guess the movie we're discussing, Reservoir Dogs, it's not available on free streaming on any of those services. So as a subscriber, you wouldn't get anything. You would have to purchase the movie digitally or rent it in some manner.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, I usually check that, but I didn't because I already owned it. But yeah,
I did a quick look. I mean, I owned it on I don't own a Blu-ray, but I did watch the DVD, the 15th anniversary Gas Can Edition, which I guess is about 10 years old at this point. Maybe Reservoir Dogs isn't the best example, considering it's a movie that's had dozens of releases over the years. But you're talking about classic films, genre pictures, niche films. A lot of that stuff you're not going to find unless you get lucky, extremely lucky in many cases.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, personally, I'm not sure how I feel about the closing of this particular store. I mean, I'm definitely, you know, sad about it. But that was such a big part of my life for such a long time that I'm not sure I'm coming to terms with it just yet.
I feel the same way. You know, I was there yesterday, so.
Yeah, I think the next time I go to Baltimore, if it's after the closure, and I'm tinkering around with the idea of coming back beforehand, but if I come back after the closure, like, that would always be one of the big things I want to check off on my list of things to do when I go back to Baltimore, would be to go and visit the Suncoast and see the gang, see everybody.
Leave some flowers at the gate.
So,
pour beer on the floor.
Yeah, so, you know, I just feel bad for a lot of the customers who I know are still there, you know, every day and every week, and who just love that place. You know, those people are typically, you know who I mean. I don't want to say their names, you know, on the podcast, but you know, the regulars, what are they going to do? A lot of those regulars are, you know, older people who probably don't subscribe to streaming services at all. So they're going to be relegated to just the bargain bin at Walmart for their movie shopping.
There were a handful of customers that came in yesterday, people that you would be familiar with, as I was. And, you know, they seem to take the news well, but in particular, like, I ended up doing a short shift yesterday. In particular, I tried to have my experience with them, which in most cases will be my final experience with them in person.
Right.
I tried to make it extra helpful and thoughtful and comfortable for them.
Well, you and know? You've always been one of the best employees there, like over the last 20 years that you've been an employee of that place. You know, people walk in knowing that you're going to give them a good experience.
You don't need to toot my horn, man.
That hasn't been the case with every employee that we've had at that place, but in particular, you know, I'll give you a shout out for being an amazing customer service representative at that store.
All right, you don't need to keep this in here. You don't need to keep that in there. I don't know. I feel weird now.
Nah, it's cool. Because the segue here is that the movie that we're about to talk to was birthed...
Also customer service oriented.
Yeah, I mean, this movie was birthed by a guy who didn't go to film school, who worked at a video store, who watched a lot of movies, and that was his film school. This young boy from Southern California, his name was Quentin Tarantino. And he wrote a screenplay called Reservoir Dogs. And, you know, the rest is history. He's now considered one of our great American artists. So.
Yeah.
So there you go. We don't even need to talk about Reservoir Dogs. That's, you know, bam.
Go ahead.
But do you know anything about the making of this movie? Like, I'm no expert on Tarantino. I certainly enjoy all of his films.
I mean, I only know, like, some related anecdotes. I certainly didn't do any research on the movie for this recording. Like, I know the script made its way to Harvey Keitel, and he agreed to produce it.
The story behind that is that Tarantino's producing partner, Lawrence Bender, at the time, was in an acting class. And they took the screenplay for Reservoir Dogs and gave it to Lawrence Bender's acting teacher, whose wife was in New York and was a member of the Actors Studio with Harvey Keitel. So they gave it to the teacher read it and liked it, he gave it to his wife, she read it and liked it, and she put it directly into the hands of Harvey Keitel, and 3 days later, Tarantino and Lawrence Bender were on a call with Harvey Keitel from New York, and Keitel verbally committed to wanting to be a part of the project. So, I mean, that's like a one in a million chance, because everybody in Hollywood, the old, I guess the cliche is that everyone walks around with their scripts everywhere. So if they bump into a producer or somebody important, they can say, hey, I have a script. But in this case, floating your script around really actually got them, you know, their movie made. So, hey, good for them. And, you know, thankfully, it's a pretty good one.
Pretty good. It's pretty good.
Well, I don't think it's one of his best movies, personally, but I do enjoy it, you know, and I certainly see the influences, you know, and Tarantino has always been a guy who wears his influences on his sleeve, you know, and this particular picture is no different. So, but, hey, what's Reservoir Dogs about?
It's a crime film that primarily handles the events before and after a heist, and the search of these criminals to find a mole who may have tipped the authorities off for their crime. It's not a mystery on who the criminal is, as the audience knows, but it's a tense thriller in that you're waiting to find out whether these criminals, many of them very violent, find out who the undercover police officer is.
Right.
Okay.
I certainly like this film. You know, crime films, film noir, you know, that's something that we've talked quite a bit about over the course of this show.
Yeah, a lot of crime films, now that I think about it.
Yeah. So. You know what's really funny is how this movie sort of like directly ties into a number of the movies that we've already done. You know, I obviously Jean-Pierre Melville and his movies has been a huge influence on anybody who wants to make a crime film. But Melville's actually, I think, thanked in the credits by Tarantino as an influence for this movie. And the movie that we talked about in reference to Melville, Le Cercle Rouge, has sort of a doomed quality to it, just like Reservoir Dogs does. And the shootout at the end of Reservoir Dogs is probably more similar to a couple of other films that we'll talk about. But the ending of Le Cercle Rouge and the ending of Reservoir Dogs essentially sees the death of pretty much everybody.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So there's sort of a tie in there. We talked about The Thing a couple of episodes ago, and The Thing, has a terrific quality of starting out with a large ensemble cast and then sort of whittling it down to just two survivors at the end. So the whole movie is about sort of like taking that group and knocking them off essentially like one at a time, the way you would in a horror movie. And Reservoir Dogs sort of, it kind of does the opposite. You get that beginning scene, which we'll talk about, the opening scene of the movie. But once they get, like, once the heist has happened and we start to get the story from the point of view of the characters after the heist, it's all about starting with a small group of people and then getting into a larger, more ensemble piece until the climax.
Well, I guess like The Thing too, you know, there's a lot of suspicion that gets
right. Absolutely.
Thrown around. So,
yep, that's where I was going with it.
Okay, acceptable.
You know, it's funny. Like I was thinking about this last night, and I didn't write this down, but there have been a couple of major like movements in American cinema, and the last big movement in American cinema, before the 1990s was the American New Wave in the 70s. And, you know, with directors like Brian De Palma and Martin Scorsese and George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and those guys who all went to film school in the late 60s and early 70s. And in many cases, like, and I know because, you know, I've done some reading on that era and on George Lucas in particular, I know that, like, a lot of those guys were exposed to films, art house films, foreign films, experimental films through the film school system that they never would have seen before. And that's why all those new ideas, you know, percolated to the surface and became part of the Hollywood mainstream in the 1970s, because those guys had been exposed to a lot of that stuff. Mm-hmm. In the 90s, you had a group of filmmakers who essentially rebelled against the idea that film school was a necessary process for wanting to become a filmmaker. You had, you know, people like Kevin Smith, Quentin Tarantino, I'm drawing a blank. Paul Thomas Anderson is another one. And these guys essentially grew up as the first generation of kids with home video and cable TV. So they were able to sort of like rewatch, record, analyze these movies in a way that nobody ever could before. And that's why the next big independent movement of cinema was American cinema in the 1990s. Because these kids who grew up on video and were able to speak a different language and had a wider breadth of knowledge, you know, but hey, I mean, maybe that's not necessarily a complete thought, but like, as I was rewatching the film last night, that's what I was thinking of as I was watching the film. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think like the history of that generation of filmmakers is something you could discuss endlessly. I don't know if it's something you could easily distill into like a handful of movements or influences. That's something that, you know, might be worth a discussion. You know, if we do a podcast episode aside from a film, just, you know, just film history or something. That's something I think would be very interesting to discuss.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about this cast a little bit.
Okay.
You know, Harvey Keitel was the only major star. And then, of course, you've got Lawrence Bender. Or not Lawrence Bender. Lawrence Tierney. Sorry. Who was a... I would not go so far as to say he was a big star in the 1940s. He had two major hits in the 40s. One of them was Dillinger, which is a movie I've never seen. And the other one was Born to Kill. And he had a reputation for being sort of a bad boy off screen. And he, you know, he played a real tough son of a bitch in the movies that he was in. And so... You know, that's the kind of personality that I think Tarantino was drawn to, you know, by casting him. And he's good in the part. I heard, though, that he was almost fired for not knowing his lines and not, you know, not sticking to the dialogue.
Well, I guess you look at a guy like that, and it's a first-time director like Tarantino, who we know now is a boisterous, loudmouth, kind of abrasive.
Sure.
I think it'd be easy for him to kind of think, why am I taking direction from some punk kid? You know, if it wasn't for Harvey, I wouldn't be here.
Right. Absolutely. You got, you know, Tim Roth, Steve Buscemi, Michael Madsen, Eddie Bunker, who, to be honest, I know he's been in a bunch of other stuff, but I can't think off the top of my head of a single movie that he's been in aside from this one.
Runaway Train.
Yeah. Chris Penn, who looks like a tall, red-headed Jonah Hill in this movie.
Wearing a tracksuit.
He totally does, doesn't he?
More than a little.
Yeah. You got Stephen Wright as the voice of K-Billy Super Sounds of the 70s.
Yep.
Which is also interesting because I think one of Tarantino's I don't know if he's ever admitted to this, but one of Tarantino's influences for this film had to have been Stanley Kubrick's The Killing.
I've never seen that film.
Oh, it's really good. But the Killing is about a heist, and the whole thing is done through non-linear storytelling and flashbacks, just like Reservoir Dogs. But The Killing also uses radio of a horse race throughout the film as a sort of just like a signifier, you know, of what is to come and what is happening outside of what you're seeing visually. And I think that the way Tarantino uses the K-Billy soundtrack and Stephen Wright's dialogue, it's a little bit reminiscent of that as well. So, I mean, it's a good group of actors. I mean, you know, in particular, Michael Madsen, Steve Buscemi, Tim Roth, and Harvey Keitel are really the leads of the film, I guess, because they have the most screen time. Roth and Keitel are both very, very good. Roth, in particular, when we first meet Roth, after the opening scene, he's already been shot, and he's like writhing in pain in the back seat, and there's blood everywhere. And I was thinking last night that this film would be a terrific movie to watch in black and white, because a lot of the backgrounds are very kind of plain, the setting is very simple. You're just in that warehouse for most of the movie. And I don't know, I think a black and white sort of like gives it a starkness and hides like lower production values better than color movies do. But I think I would miss that blood red everywhere that this movie has.
Yeah. One of the things that, it's also, something to do with like the time period this film was made, but Tarantino does still tend to use a lot of authentic blood effects in current films, as opposed to a lot of the digital blood that pops up in most violent films these days.
Yeah. Even in his more recent films like Hateful Eight and Django Unchained, mm-hmm. He loves Kill Bill too. You know, he loves the blood. You can talk a little bit more about this, but that's like the Hong Kong influence. Cause that's not
Hong Kong and
European films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Japanese film too. Samurai Pictures, I think, particularly have a reputation of having splurting like blood geysers coming out of people.
Yeah, and it you know, Tarantino was a huge fan of spaghetti westerns and a lot of the Italian giallo films, and both of those use red and super red, like unnatural looking blood in those movies too.
Yep.
I tried to find a copy of City on Fire, but it's not available anywhere. I did find YouTube has a copy of it, but it's not subtitled or dubbed. It's just the original version. So,
you know, I was thinking about buying a copy of City on Fire after our discussion a couple days ago.
Yeah.
There was a recent Blu-ray release from Korea, which seems to have a 2K master print on there. And it sounds like it's something I'll probably be picking up sometime before the end of the year, at least, so. It's been a long time since I've watched the film.
Well, I watched... do you know who Mike White is?
Mike White. Like Jack Black and Mike White?
No. Mike White is from a podcast called The Projection Booth, which I don't subscribe to. But I know of it, and I know of him. And he had a YouTube video up that had like a sort of like a side by side comparison of City on Fire and Reservoir Dogs, and I gotta tell you, I don't know if incriminating is the right word, but obviously Tarantino took a lot from City on Fire.
There's a lot of Hong Kong films in particular that have that heroic bloodshed theme, as in criminals and cops coming together, and you know, a lot of death at the end of the picture.
Yeah.
So, I mean, visually you can look at that stuff and see, yeah, it's this and this and this. And, you know, I'm not necessarily going to defend him against it, but every director, you know, of course, has their own influences, and some of them want to make those references more obvious than others.
Yeah. Well, I'm not condemning Tarantino for it. I mean, if you condemn Tarantino for borrowing on City on Fire, you have to nail George Lucas for Hidden Fortress, and you have to, I mean, there's so much more, you know, like, I mean, ideas get recycled by people all the time, and sometimes it's purposeful, and sometimes it is subliminal to them, and a lot of times these comparisons end up getting a little bit forced, but I mean, I think Tarantino denied that he ever saw City on Fire, and I would not believe him on that point.
I definitely don't.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely saw City on Fire and digested it and worked those ideas into this screenplay. And if he did it,
did he actually say that? Did he say he never saw City on Fire?
I remember seeing a quote as I was going through like the liner notes, like on my Blu-ray copy of Reservoir Dogs, where somebody had said like, you know, this is just like City on Fire. And he was like, sounds good. I'm going to enjoy watching that. Something to that effect. That's not a verbatim quote, but okay. He basically played it off like he had not seen it. But being a Chow Yun-Fat movie, I'm sure he probably saw it.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely heard him talking about like Hong Kong films before too. So it's
oh yeah, definitely. Yeah,
that's no way. I mean, you're not gonna have a company release a Wong Kar-wai movie and not be familiar with Hong Kong action movies.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So do we have any favorite moments from Reservoir Dogs that you want to talk about?
Well, we're talking about Tim Roth earlier. I really like the scene when it kind of transitions to him building his character's background.
And it transitions
with the storytelling scene. It transitions from him looking at himself in like a mirror to telling the story to, you know, ingratiate himself into this cadre of criminals.
Yeah, and absolutely. The commode story, right?
Yeah.
I think what Tarantino does, I don't know if I'm going to say this in a way that is going to be as coherent as I want it to be, but Tarantino's use of flashbacks and flash forwards and sort of pictorializing things that don't actually happen, that are being told, but they're being made up. Like specifically the commode story when he's in the bathroom. None of that actually happened. That's not reality. But he shot it and pictorializes it for the audience. And it's in a flashback. So it's a very complex structure, I think, that he is dealing with in the film. And for a first-time filmmaker, you know, this could have been... this could have been screwed up in more ways than it could have gone right. And I think it's a testament to Tarantino and to Sally Menke, his editor.
Yeah.
Hi, Sally. Yeah. That this works in the way that it does. It's beautifully done. And that particular scene with the cops and the dog and him having the hash brick in the bathroom is hilarious. The cops, the guy who's telling the story is overacting in the exact manner that somebody would when they're sort of telling a tall tale to their buddies. Mm-hmm. And when he presses the hand dryer, Tarantino uses like a jet engine sound. And like, I watched this with Chelsea and I started laughing like well before that scene hit that moment. And she was like, what the hell are you laughing at? And I was like, just wait. And it's like when he hits the hand dryer and the engine sound comes on, like I was just like cackling out loud because I think it's super funny. So Tarantino's sense of...
You're talking about like, I guess like the character narration and like exaggerated things in my mind as you were talking about it, all I could think about was when Jimmy in Pulp Fiction is talking about how when his wife gets home.
Absolutely. That's the same thing.
That's all I could think about when she walks in and sees Samuel Jackson, John Travolta holding a dead body.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Man, that's one of my favorite scenes in a movie, period.
Well, I think Pulp Fiction is Tarantino's masterpiece. Like, I think Reservoir Dogs is a very good movie. I enjoy it tremendously, and I'm glad that we rewatched it for the 25th anniversary. But I think Pulp Fiction was the first Tarantino movie I saw, and I got to tell you, I literally fell out of my seat laughing during the Christopher Walken scene in Pulp Fiction in the theater.
I've heard that story.
Yeah. So that's one of my favorite theatrical experiences ever, because I had no idea what that movie was going to be like. I mean, we just knew that it was supposed to be good, and it was supposed to be violent, and it was R-rated, and I was like, all right, well, we're going to go. And I just was completely unprepared for Tarantino as a filmmaker and as a writer. And there's a lot of that in Reservoir Dogs. Going back to the opening scene, the opening scene is brilliant because it's sort of an announcement of his trademark style. You know, the authentic sounding conversations that feature pop culture knowledge. It's, you know, his writing's more character based than plot centric. That whole Like a Virgin speech is, it seems so grounded in the real world. Like, you and your buddies would talk about something like that. You know what I mean? It's not something that you would have seen in a movie 10 years before that, though. And the I don't tip talk is something that gets requoted constantly all the time.
Oh, for the record, everyone, you should tip.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I love Keitel's response where he's just like, you don't know what you're talking about. We have a buddy, our good buddy Randy, who actually looks a little bit like Steve Buscemi.
A little bit.
You know, it's funny. I wasn't going to go there, but all I could think of watching Reservoir Dogs was if Randy's voice was a little bit like higher pitched, maybe. Yeah, like he totally would be like a dead ringer for Buscemi. You threw me off there. I can't remember what I was going to talk about.
You're welcome.
Oh, well,
no tipping speech.
Yeah. Oh, there's the dog in the background. She's barking at something. Okay. Sorry, guys. I'm not in the best.
The studio.
Yeah, I'm not in the best place to record today. So I've got the dog everywhere and the heater on, and so the garbage truck outside. There's the dog again.
You want to take a minute, man? Does she calm down?
No, I'd have to go downstairs. Anyway, that opening scene is one hell of an introduction to not just the characters, but to Tarantino as a filmmaker.
Yes.
And can I ask you a serious question?
Okay.
Why in the hell does nobody in Hollywood know how to utilize Michael Madsen besides Tarantino?
You know, I'm trying to think of movies that he's been in that,
not a hell of a lot of...
You're right, man.
Yeah, I mean, like, Species.
The Michael Madsen classic.
I mean, I didn't pull up his internet movie database, you know, but, like, he hasn't been in a ton of great stuff outside of Reservoir Dogs, and I really, really like him in the Kill Bill movies, too. But Tarantino just sort of got him in a way, like... Tarantino's style is very sort of like cool. It's about making his actors sound and look cool and do things that are cool. Very much like, in a very different way, in a much more louder style than Melville did. But we talked about that a little bit in the Le Cercle Rouge episode, where how everything Melville did was cool and his actors looked really cool doing everything. Like, Tarantino takes that approach and he just kind of like throws the punk rock into it. And Madsen in particular, I just don't get it. Like when I was watching Reservoir Dogs again, I would look at Madsen and he was sort of like this weird combination of James Dean and Montgomery Clift. Like, he had like the body type of Montgomery Clift, but he sort of like furrows his brow and delivers dialogue a little bit like James Dean, even though he doesn't have that like a James Dean style voice. And nobody got it except for Tarantino. And I think it's a real missed opportunity that he hasn't been in better films in his career.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time though, I guess he also perhaps has been struggling with a lot of stuff in his private life. Like I've always heard stories of, alcoholism and other things. And, you know, I guess when you end up, thank God for Tarantino, I guess, but like he ends up picking a lot of atrocious films, you know, everything from Sci-Fi Channel original movies to direct to video fare that has virtually no budget, smaller yeah. budgets than Reservoir Dogs, you know?
Yeah, you might be right. I'm not privy to, you know, to any of the personal issues that he's been going through. I just know that he's a heck of a talented actor who isn't in enough. I want to see him in more.
I want to see him in good stuff. Is yeah. The thing, what you mean. Because he's in more. Plenty more.
All right, yes. Let me clarify. I want to see him in better movies. Yes. I want to see him working with better filmmakers like Tarantino.
Yeah.
So. And Tarantino as an actor, hard pass.
Yeah, thankfully he gets knocked off pretty early on, so.
Yeah, I guess at this point he's sort of like, the acting bug has sort of like passed him a little bit. But he's sort of obnoxious in real life, and that sort of carries through a little bit in his acting. And I'm not a big fan of him as an actor in this movie or in like From Dusk Till Dawn and stuff like that. Although I do like him as Jimmy in Pulp Fiction. That's where it all came together. But you know, he
I
should
like him as Jimmy, but he's still not a good actor in that role.
No. But it's funny because nobody delivers Tarantino dialogue better than Tarantino. He just can't play every character.
Yeah.
So what else?
I don't know. Well, do you have a scene that you in particular really like?
Well, I think the scene of this movie is you know, the what's the name of the song? The Steelers' yep. Wheels Stuck in the Middle with You.
Yeah.
The ear cutting scene. That's certainly one of the most memorable scenes in the movie. For me, it is the most memorable scene in the movie.
Oh, absolutely. It's a long cut and it's very uncomfortable at times. He doesn't put it on screen, of course. You know, the camera pans away for the moment.
Right. You know, instead of cutting, you know, I think that's an interesting choice. I'm not sure why he chooses to do that instead of sort of like, you know, cutting maybe to the other side of the head, other than the fact that he just wanted to do a one-er. But yeah, I think the guy who plays Marvin Nash is Kirk Baltz, and he's pretty good. You know, I mean, he gets the shit kicked out of him. He gets his face razor bladed. He gets his ear chopped off, and you know, like when he's talking to Tim Roth, he's got like shit in his eyeball. Like he's got blood everywhere. He really sells the pain. That's the one thing. Like I was talking about Tim Roth riling in the back seat. Like that's the one thing that I think Tarantino like really gets in this movie is that, like, you know, the pain that comes along with that violence. A lot of
the pain that like you see in the Tarantino film also is accompanied with a lot of like anger too.
Yeah.
But
people have criticized his movies for being super violent, and they definitely are. And I think the violence gets a little bit more cartoony towards the end of his, or the more recent films that he's done. But early in both Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs in particular, when people get punched and kicked and shot and cut and he does not brush it aside like most movies that have violence do. You know, it's not, people don't get shot and get back up and start doing things. Like it's it is catastrophic in its violence.
Catastrophic, like as in, you know, like, you know, someone's out and out.
Yeah, yeah, it's, and Blonde is a complete psychopath.
Oh, yeah, sure, he's crazy.
Which is great, and I love it.
Great for the film, yeah, of course.
Yeah, but that's you know, Keitel keeps saying that he's a madman, and you know, nice guy Eddie and Joe, you know, don't want to believe him, but he really is a psychopath. Uh-huh. other heist movies have used pseudonyms with their characters, but I like the idea that they're all like colors. But I was thinking that like Blonde is not really a color, so instantly, because everyone's a color, but he's Mr. Blonde, you instantly know that something's off with him a little bit. I think, yeah. So it's a cool, like, exception to like what they did with their names, but I think in a way it's sort of a signifier that he's, you know, different than the rest of the guys. And there are plenty of other heist movies where they use pseudonyms, like, and I know I mentioned this one in our Le Cercle Rouge podcast, but Kansas City Confidential is one of them, where the entire heist is supposed to hinge on the idea that they all have, like, that deniability, that they don't know who each other are. So that's probably something that Tarantino drew from as well, because that's, you know, one of the more popular, like, heist films out there. And this is a heist film where we don't see the heist, which is unusual. A lot of heist movies, go to great lengths to visualize and make these heists, elaborate and difficult and bring tension into the film. And Tarantino, does away with that completely and creates an aftermath full of tension. And I like that about it too.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I think like, you know, definitely, you know, the heist itself, you know, I think everyone's seen it before, but I think that, yeah, definitely the aftermath, like, it's way more thrilling as the characters come in, and, you know, it's a waiting game, basically, because you're waiting for the police to storm the warehouse.
Yeah. And it's not really a heist, it's more of a robbery. Like, that's, I think there's a difference there.
Yeah, also, like, you know, I'm not really sure, like, you know, like, what did they hit? Like, a diamond exchange? Like, a truck? You know, a courier or what?
Yeah, it was a jewelry place that was that had a shipment of like uncut stone or polished stones. They usually handle uncut stones, I think. Joe says to Larry.
Yep.
But on this particular day, they were getting a big shipment of polished diamonds. So that was their goal. And Buscemi ends up with the diamonds, although he gets caught by the cops. I like that you can hear what's going on with Buscemi's character, Mr. Pink, while the camera's focused on Keitel and Roth as Roth tells Keitel that he's a cop.
Yeah.
It's like hearing footsteps behind you. Like, we're watching them, but you know the cops are closing in on Pink, and then you hear him get shot, right? Or am I wrong about that?
No, I think...
Or do they just capture? Do they take him alive?
Well, I think they take him alive.
It's hard to tell. It's vague.
I always thought that he was the one who survives.
Yeah.
Because he definitely seems a little bit more of a. I don't want to say pussy. but like he has that line at the beginning of the movie when he's talking about like how if you're in my way, I'll move you. But right. He definitely doesn't seem like the type of guy that'll. Like, that would do it. I mean, he could shoot, like, an innocent woman or whatever on the street, but that's, yeah, I don't think that he'd be able to do it against, like, that many things. And if I recall correctly, I think one of, like, the taglines for the movie when it was coming out was something along the lines of, in 2 hours, all but one of these men will be dead. So, you know, I totally assume
that... Well, Tim Roth probably lives, right?
No, he probably dies, right? He's been bleeding out for hours.
Well, if what Larry says is true, it takes a long time to die from a gut shot. They probably can save him.
Well, I mean,
but anyway, so maybe, Buscemi maybe might he might get out.
Fire, but like Chow Yun Fat dies in City on Fire. So.
Spoiler alert!
You're welcome. So now you don't need to watch it.
But it's for as much violence and as much blood as we see in the film, like you mentioned earlier with the Steeler's Wheel ear cutting scene, Tarantino moves the camera away from the most grotesque violence. And when Keitel gets shot at the end of the film, he moves the camera away and has Keitel just fall off to one side. So we don't actually get to see the gratuitousness of that either. So I always thought that was an interesting choice, given how much blood we see everywhere in the film.
Well, I mean, you hear gunshots. Do you think one of those shots could have been him pulling the trigger on Orange?
It's possible. I don't think he would, though. I think the whole dynamic between him and Orange was that he was more of like a big brother figure or a father figure to Orange, I think.
Orange tells him he's a cop. So then White knows he killed, you know.
Yeah, but he holds the gun to Orange's face, though, but he can't bring himself to pull the trigger, though. So I don't think he does at any point. I don't think he can. I think the one thing that separates Larry from the rest of the guys is that he's a professional thief, but he's not a killer, even though he did shoot a couple of cops, like, you know, to get away. Mm-hmm. But, like, he seems like a stand-up guy as opposed to some of the other characters in the film.
Yeah, career criminals.
Yeah, and the relationship that develops between Orange and White, the Tim Roth and the Harvey Keitel characters, is what the entire movie hinges on once Joe shows up. Because once Joe's, you know, he rightly accuses Orange of being the undercover cop and saying that he doesn't have evidence, but he knows it in his gut. And, you know, you don't need evidence when you have instincts. I like that line. Keitel, like, immediately goes to his defense. You know, like, this kid took a bullet, and this is a good kid, and you're wrong, Joe. And I think the pain of knowing that he was wrong is horrible, but I still don't think he kills Orange.
I think that's a good point. I still think that Tim Roth dies at the end. I mean, he's in pretty shitty shape.
Yeah, he really is. He looks white as a sheet, like, and like pasty white, like towards the end of the film too. So
yeah, it looks like he was like submerged for an hour.
I guess we'll never know until Tarantino does Reservoir Dogs 2. Tim Roth is back, undercover again.
The Vega Chronicles.
Whatever happened to that Vega Brothers movie they were going to do?
Michael Madsen got fat.
So Travolta's fat too. It's too late now. Travolta went crazy too, so he couldn't use either one of those guys anymore.
Yeah, I guess so.
Even though Travolta was really good in that OJ TV series that Ryan Murphy produced. He's horrible, but he's horrible in the best way possible. He's so great.
Okay.
All right. So, what else? Anything else you want to talk about before we wrap it up?
I don't know what else needs to be said. Reservoir Dogs is a good movie. It's a really solid crime film, and to be honest, like I only watched the movie this morning before we started recording, but immediately afterwards, I really wanted to watch more crime movies. So, I mean, that's definitely not the right type of film to watch this time of year, you know, a couple weeks out from Christmas. But
well, aside from City on Fire, which obviously was borrowed from for this particular film, do you have any other recommendations you want to make for people who love Reservoir Dogs but want to expand outside of Tarantino's filmography?
Well, I mean, there's some films that are, like, referenced heavily in this film. You mentioned The Killing, so Kansas City Confidential would be good ones to watch. Maybe something like, I asked you earlier, the French film Band Apart, of which, like, the scene in slow motion where everyone is walking in their suits, that's a reference of, or yeah, from. For other crime films, though, that are like it, I don't know. Outside of, like, Tarantino's work, you may have a hard time finding stuff that is up at that level of quality, though.
Well, certainly they're not going to have that firecracker dialogue that Tarantino brings. It's, but yeah, I
some of the Guy Ritchie crime films are pretty good, you know?
Yeah, like, definitely. Snatch would be a good one.
Snatch and
Lock, Stock.
I see. I'm not as big a fan of Lock, Stock as a lot of other people are. I think it's good, but I definitely don't hold it at the same level as a lot of his other films.
I think I like Lock, Stock better than Snatch.
Oh, for real?
I think when I first saw Snatch, because Snatch is a more polished film, and stylistically it has a little bit more verve to it, but I think I just enjoy Lock, Stock better.
Okay, maybe I should rewatch it. It's been a number of years, I think.
CJ, you're wrong. That's the comment section. What? Lock, Stock over Snatch? You're a fucking buffoon, Talbot.
Yeah, buffoon. With five O's.
Alright, cool. What are we going to do for our next episode? Are we going to do a Christmas movie?
I guess we have to. Do you think you can edit it
out? We don't have to. We can just do regular movies, but if you want to do a Christmas movie, we can.
Nah, I don't want to force a Christmas movie, so I'm sure we can decide on something.
Well, we can do...
Four Dogs was my pick, so I guess you have a pick now?
I'll let you know. We'll talk about it off air.
Yeah. All right.
The dog is back with a squeaky toy, so we're going to have to wrap this up because she is a ball of energy right now. All right. I think that's it. Where can people find you on the internet?
I guess you can find me at filmsmash.com or on Twitter at JuniorBeho.
Stop. Sorry. She's like all getting up on me and everything too.
You're ruining my plug, dog.
All right, filmsmash.com or at JuniorBeho on Twitter. And for myself, you can find me at Setting the Frame on Twitter on the Celluloid Jelly Board on Facebook. That's the only two places on the internet that I generally post or talk about anything. So,
yeah, okay.
Cool. So I'll get that Superman episode out ASAP. We'll get this episode out after that, and then we'll have another episode before Christmas for you. And so you guys let us know what you think of Reservoir Dogs, and if you have any suggestions, of course, you know where to find us.
Thanks, guys.
All right, cool. Thanks, Azar.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to Celluloid Jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.